And journalist Will Potter, I wanted to ask you, what's been the impact of the campaign of PETA to expose the mistreatment of fish at SeaWorld? You're seeing now on television almost BP-like ads on television constantly by SeaWorld claiming that it's treating its animals properly.
Well, when people make a lot of money by abusing animals, they don't like having that abuse exposed because it means they lose profits and consumers don't like that very much. And that's exactly what's happened with SeaWorld and especially with Blackfish. I mean, it's really unprecedented how quickly the tides have turned against this company. In just a couple of years, there's been a groundswell of public opposition and just a cultural change in how we regard these animals and using animals for entertainment at places like SeaWorld. And I think these types of tactics that I've reported on extensively from corporations are truly an act of desperation when activists become incredibly effective at changing cultural values, cultural discussion, and also threatening corporate profits. I think if anything, the example of this infiltration and attempts at provocation show the lengths to which these companies are willing to go rather than change their business practices and respond to consumer pressure.
You, in fact, have exposed other corporations infiltrating groups like PETA and others, Will.
Right. And we're just really seeing the tip of the iceberg with this, I think. I mean, for a long time, I've written about tactics like this, disruption, infiltration, provocation by the FBI, which we've seen for decades. But we don't know as much about what corporations are doing. Some of the other examples I have reported on, though, are Coca-Cola was exposed through WikiLeaks of contracting with a private security firm called Stratfor to spy on PETA activists and gather information about their protest activity. Burger King also hired spies to gather information about the Student Farm Worker Alliance who were protesting their labor practices. And similarly, Greenpeace found out that companies like Dow Chemical were going through their dumpsters and hiring private firms to gather information in illegal ways to do that. So this is really fits into that pattern of behavior. But what's truly disturbing is we don't know the extent to which this is happening. At least with the FBI, there's some ostensible oversight or accountability. With these corporations, there's nothing like that.
I want to thank you all for being with us. A fascinating discussion. We will continue this discussion. Journalist Will Potter with us from Washington and PETA volunteer Hal Weiss, as well as People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals litigation director Matthew Strugar joining us from Los Angeles. That does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Ameen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkaff, Hani Masood, Ravi Karan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with guest host Doug McVeigh. Today's guest is Jason Zeidenberg of the Justice Policy Institute. We'll talk about prisons, community corrections, rehabilitation, and reintegration of formerly incarcerated people into society at large.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 14th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 16th through the 19th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. Hosted by Colorado-based Yonder Mountain String Band, this year's festival includes bands such as Grinsky's Bluegrass, the infamous String Dusters, Keller Williams' Grateful Grass, Sook Twins, and more. There will also be a late-night stage, an early-morning Cascadia stage, and daytime movies and seminars. Again, that's the 14th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 16th through the 19th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. More information about the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair Saturday, July 25th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. with an after-party on Clinton Street from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. The community parade, Metamorphosis, will start at 10:45 a.m. There will also be artisan, craft, and community booths, sidewalk sales, live music, food, and more. Again, that's the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair, Saturday, July 25th, from 10 to 5 p.m., with an after-party on Clinton Street going until 9 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling all down the San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy.
Good morning. Good morning, Portland. It is 8:05 a.m. This is Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO. I'm Doug McVeigh. I'm sitting in this morning for our regular host, Paul Rowland. We're going to be talking today about criminal justice reform and sentencing reform, efforts to reduce over-incarceration. It's a coincidence that the president happens to be on the same page that we are. Yesterday, he was speaking in Philadelphia at the NAACP annual convention. He said that in far too many cases, the punishment simply doesn't fit the crime. Truer words have rarely been spoken. Yesterday was the first day of a two-part hearing on Capitol Hill in front of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. The hearing is criminal justice reform. Yesterday, they heard from senators, including Cory Booker, and from other members of Congress, such as Representative Bobby Scott, and also two sitting governors, the governor of Delaware and the governor of Alabama, all talking in favor of sentencing reform and reducing the over-criminalization and over-incarceration in our country. Today, those hearings continue. There are advocates from all sides of the argument, from both ends of the political spectrum and in between, who'll be talking to that committee about the need for sentencing reform. In the country currently, there are some 6,899,000 persons under the supervision of the adult correctional systems. That's at the end of the year in 2013. That's a slight reduction from 2012, a decrease of about 41,000 people. We have so very many people sitting behind bars. The president recently issued commutations of sentences. That's when a person who is serving time in prison essentially is going to be released. Their sentence reduced from life or from 20 or some outrageous number down to the time that they've served. That's a commutation. There are also pardons. That's when people have their rights restored, because when you are convicted of a federal felony, you lose certain rights. After you're released, you don't have those rights. The state of Oregon, a long time ago, stopped the practice of felony disenfranchisement. That's where people who have been convicted of a felony lose their right to vote. In some states, that can only be restored by asking very nicely and filing paperwork with the governor and hoping that they approve it. In some states, you still don't have the right to vote after you have been convicted of a felony. That's why people who are in that position end up moving away. And there are a lot of other things that come along with a felony conviction. So even once they get out, even once we stop putting so many people away, well, what do we do? What do we do when they come out? Today we're going to be talking with Jason Zeidenberg. Jason's the Director of Policy and Research for the Justice Policy Institute. That's a nonprofit located in D.C. that's dedicated to reducing the use of incarceration and reforming the justice system by promoting fair and effective policies. Jason, are you with me?
I'm on, Doug. It's great to be with you this morning.
Jason, it is great to hear your voice, old friend. It is great to hear your voice. So tell folks a little bit, if you would please, about the Justice Policy Institute and your work there.
Sure. The Justice Policy Institute is a research organization based in Washington, D.C., dedicated to reducing society's reliance on incarceration. Basically, over the last 15 years, we've been writing reports, research, getting the information out there that was quoted in the president's speech yesterday and being used by legislators to start with these bipartisan bills to sort of tackle mass incarceration. And I myself am a former resident of Oregon that used to work in the probation and parole department with a lot of the people that were coming out of prison, and have a good sense of how all these systems work and don't work for people when they're in jail or prison.
See, and that's one of the things that a lot of people just don't think about, and that's probably a lot of the problem. I mean, people are put away in prisons or in jails. People do something that society thinks is wrong. We throw them in a hole and forget about them. Now, community corrections seems to be getting some more support. How do you think things have gone, have been evolving over these last 15 years? Obviously, we're getting some good words from the president now, but how do you think policies have been going?
Right. So when you have a massive problem like mass incarceration, it is important to sort of look at a couple of bright sides and start moving from there. We have the President of the United States visiting a prison, making commutations for almost 50 people, talking about the need to get rid of mandatory minimums, to take the $80 billion that we're currently spending on incarceration and spending it differently. And today, unlike maybe 15, 20 years ago, Doug, when we were both working on this issue, you see real bipartisan support for this. Everyone from Senator Rand Paul to Senator Cory Booker. That's the good news. The second piece of good news is all of the challenges we've been facing in our communities around less money being available in the public sector, that's had an impact on the criminal justice debate. So particularly following the 2008 recession, there is a group of policymakers who kind of knew what the right thing was to do for years, and the combination of a drop in crime and a drop in revenue gave them the opportunity to move forward on modest changes at the state level and at the county level. So the good news is we do have this bipartisan bubble, particularly moving through Washington, but also through state capitals, saying, stop, enough. Other piece of good news, there really has been a bipartisan focus on addressing the kinds of needs of people after they've had a conviction or when they're coming out of prison, particularly around the consequences for employment, school, and housing. The Justice Department's had a real focus in on it. You see policy changes in state legislatures. All this is good news. I think we have to temper this good news with something that Julie Stewart from Families Against Mandatory Minimums said this morning about the president's 46 commutations, which was, this is the tip of the iceberg. There are 2,000 other people just in the federal system that are life without parole drug offenders. There needs to be a bigger focus on that. And then if you think about what the president did yesterday and think about the 1.5 million incarcerated in state prisons, we need a bigger focus on the mandatory minimums, on the sentencing laws, on how people come into the system, you know, say on a technical violation of their parole and probation, and really focus like a laser beam on getting more people out of these buildings. We have to do that. So I think we need to build from this historic moment. We need to have a few seconds of acknowledging how historic it is, and we need to start moving forward in state capital after state capital.
Indeed. And tip of the iceberg, the 2,000 people serving life sentences, that's out of 98,200 at last count, 98,200 people in the federal system alone who are serving time. The most serious charge on which they were convicted was a drug offense. And that's 51% of the total federal prison population. I mean, it's staggering. The numbers are staggering. 46 was a great start, but my heaven, that's just, wow.
I think like any reform movement, we do have to note when we've had some progress. It is real progress that This is the first president to actually visit a prison. It's real progress that we have leading bipartisan senators talking about these issues, introducing bills. We've got to get some of these federal bills actually passed. And then the real battle is going to be state by state, and in some cases around jails, county by county.
Indeed, and it's in everyone's best interest. I mean, it's everyone's pocketbook, and it's about public safety. How we treat these people when we put them away and when they come out, that's, you know, it's really a bottom line. Well, now, folks, this is a talk show, but it's also a call-in show. So remember the number to call if you have a question or comment for our guest, Jason Zeidenberg. The number is 503-231-8187. And, of course, you're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. You might be streaming online at kboo.fm. And, all right, while we wait for a caller, let's see. So, now, community corrections, the use of probation and parole. Has that been the basic way that we've been working on keeping the jail and prison populations down, or have we been just shoving people out of prisons and putting them in jails?
Sure. I think you need to look at probation and parole as part of a continuum, part of a longer set of tools that we need to use to get more people out of prison and jails. The nature of probation is we should be only sentencing people to the least restrictive condition that meets the needs for us, the public, and meets public safety needs and holds people accountable. And I think that probation offers a whole series of ways to hold people accountable, get them back to work, get them connected to the services they need, particularly if we can provide our officers, provide our probation departments with the tools they need to be able to do that well. In terms of parole, the Marshall Project came out with a great article this week that looked at the number of places where you simply can't get paroled, that you would be sentenced. You would be sentenced to a certain period of time, could be 10 years. All the data and all the information says longer sentences at some point really don't impact public safety. Indeed, they can make us worse by putting people in places that where they're not getting what they need. If we had an effective criminal justice system to the degree that we would ever use prison, we would be using it for a sentence that made sense by the science around the change that we want to see in the person as well as hold them accountable. So we really need return to effective parole practices. And Doug, if there's one thing I think people in Oregon need to be focusing in on, it's the Measure 11 sentencing laws in the state, which voters enacted through an initiatives process almost 20 plus years ago, which effectively locks people into these long mandatory minimum sentences. And research, RAND Corporation, Oregon legislature has studied it. It's showing that the sentence lengths aren't making the impact on behavior change and crime that we'd like to see. So even in the area where your listeners are, we can make a difference on this issue. And Measure 11 is a perfect example of the kind of thing that needs to be tackled in states around the country if we ever want to see prison populations come down.
Absolutely. Now we have a caller. All right. James, how you doing this morning?
Actually, I'm doing great. It's good to hear that the over-criminalization of our country is finally getting the light that it sorely needs. I have a mother who was convicted of felony offenses many, many years ago and definitely repaid her debt to society, but still struggles with not only the felony on her record, but with the stigma that comes with it, that, you know, that somehow she's less than any other person simply because of the mistake that's made and that she's made. It's so good to hear. You know, I'm really, I mean, I agree, we do need to take a moment and pause a great action, but, you know, continue on down the road. Yeah, no, this is just a great thing to hear. It's very uplifting.
Well, thank you, James. I mean, that's just it. When the announcement came out that the president was going to commute some sentences, I thought, great. Get back to me when this really happens. I'll be happy to give credit where it's due, when it's due. But, you know, I'll wait until it's actually due. And he did a good thing. 46 people are going to be released. 46 people who, well, what kind of programs do these folks end up, Jason, what kind of programs will these folks have, these 46 people who are being freed? What kind of help are they going to get getting back into society, reintegrating into the community?
Well, when the system is working the way that we want it to, the system is using scientific tools to figure out what treatment, what services, what connection to housing, what connection to employment these individuals need to move on with their lives. And I think the good news, this being Probation and Parole Officers Week, is that we've improved our ability to know that kind of stuff. And that's really good news. My hope is that, particularly for the individuals that have spent a lot of time in prison, is that the Bureau of Prisons has been working with them over the past few years to make sure that families have connections to them, so that there was an opportunity through this clemency to reconnect quickly to family or positive connections in their community, so when they come home, they get the welcome that they deserve. And I'm hopeful that even in a federal bureaucracy where there's 100,000 people locked up, that our federal parole officers will be working with these folks to make sure that they're connected to the housing, treatment, services, and programming that they'll need to make a safe return home.
Right on.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great to see. Yeah, it's people with the programs that they have available to them right now. I don't know. I haven't seen too much out here, but it's I don't know. It seems like you have to be like the model, you know, the model inmate in order to have access to a lot of the things that they have for people upon release. But really, you know, we should be helping everyone to become the best person that they can be given the situations they're in. So anyway, no, I appreciate the talk this morning, the topic of conversation. Thank you very much.
Oh, James, thank you, and give your mom our best. You know, his point there is so true. Drug courts, you and I have looked at these for a very long time, and the whole notion of cherry picking, the prosecutors, they decide which people coming through are going to be the best risk, are going to be basically their best bet for success, which is kind of good, I guess, but are they really just looking at their statistics and which person coming through is going to be more likely to complete the program so that, there you go, one more success story, and the percentages just keep improving.
Right. I think the president's challenge is a challenge to all of us, including our friends who are making zealous use of drug courts. I think our challenge, as the president laid out, is to use the best science to help people make the changes they need in their lives, hold people accountable for behavior, but also be working with them to ensure they don't come back into the system. If a drug court is putting somebody deeper into the system when they could have received the treatment or the supervision they needed in another kind of intervention, then that might not be working for that person. So the president's challenge is a challenge to all of us. Use the research, make good decisions, make good use of resources. Drug courts is an example of a place where we really need to focus on whether we're making the right decisions, the right people are being served by them.
Well, indeed. I mean, it was intended as a way to release the pressure, but what we saw was an increase in the number of arrests for drug offenses, and so in a way, the pressure was just maintained at a constant level. I mean, we have another caller on the line. Excellent. Joanne, how are you doing this morning?
Yeah, I'm so glad they're finally doing something about this cruel problem. It's taken them a long time. I guess the political climate wasn't right. But I have something else that needs to be done in this country. But, you know, if I had to take my Social Security disability, I'm being mentally ill instead of my medical and physical problems. And apparently that's a big weakness in the Social Security system, that they make you take it on things that you shouldn't take it on. And so in the meantime, I'm going to be 80 soon. In the meantime, when I die, that information, that is not who I am, mentally ill and disabled. There's a lot more to me that my children and grandchildren will never know. But if anybody looks in the computer in the future, that's what it'll be, that I was mentally ill. I died mentally ill and disabled and so on and so forth. But anyway, they're finally doing something about these people that shouldn't be in jail, and it's taken so long. But alleluia.
Yeah.
Indeed. Joanne, thanks for calling in. Well, and, you know, co-occurring disorders, people who are using drugs, people who have a mental disorder, people who end up being incarcerated because there's no other place to take care of them, and what you end up with, felony record, oh, diagnosis of this, and oh, you've got a history of that. Coming back from all that stuff, that's not easy. That's not easy. I want to talk to you for a minute about some of the different, we've got felony disenfranchisement, as I said before, that's a problem in some states, fewer and fewer states, thankfully. The bars to employment, people are always the question about, have you ever been arrested, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Now, we're doing pretty well with promoting the ban the box. Are you familiar with that one? How is that progressing?
So there's so many cities and so many counties and so many states now, it's actually hard to keep up with the number of places that are taking steps to basically change how government applications for employment work, so that you're not asked the question about whether you had contact with the criminal justice system until so late in the process that you're basically not being discriminated against in the employment process. So that is really good news. And in the way that this is mostly worked out is, instead of having a blank question number four, have you ever been arrested or convicted of a crime, in some sensitive cases where it might be a job where it actually requires you not to have a criminal record, they might ask at a much later stage where you're about to be offered the job. So that's good news. Where similar to the whole notion of we're making progress, but we still have challenges here. A lot of these laws don't apply to private employers. A lot of it's been focused on the public sector. And second, where we've seen, you know, you've seen progress around misdemeanor offenses or some felony offenses, that needs to be much, much broader. It really should be the case that if you're going to be asked about a previous conviction or arrest, it happens at the very last stage, and only on the most limited circumstances that relate exactly to what the job is. So we're making progress. We're making progress in acknowledgement in federal law and federal decisions. We're certainly making progress with a whole bunch of states and counties and cities that are pulling these old stupid questions off applications, but we need to go a lot further.
Oh, indeed. And we are going to be right back with our guest, Jason Zeidenberg from the Justice Policy Institute. We'll continue talking about criminal justice reform and sentencing reform and all the efforts to reduce over-incarceration that are well, in the news all around right now. First, a little bit of station business. Of course, you're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. Coming up later this morning on KBOO, at 9 on Political Perspectives, host Jennifer Kemp interviews Joel Westheimer about his book, What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good. At 9:30, we'll hear an interview with Guardian environmental reporter Suzanne Goldenberg about the significance of an email which shows Exxon has been aware of the link between its operations and climate change for quite some time. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, on Flashpoints, journalist and filmmaker John Pilger, on the last-minute flip-flop and betrayal of the Greek people by their own government. And at 11 on The Food Show, Karen Lazarus talks about her new cookbook, Sweet Mary Jane, 75 delicious cannabis-infused high-end desserts. Historian Richard Engman talks about collecting Oregon food ephemera, also OMSI's Season of Food Science, and the up-and-coming Montevilla Food Co-op. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. Not a current member? Well, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now we've got that out of the way. Let's get back to conversation. Our guest is Jason Zeidenberg with the Justice Policy Institute. The number to call if you have a question or comment is 503-231-8187. And I was going to ask you about a couple of different things. Let's just go straight into the controversial one, and that's private prisons. Back in 2000, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, privately operated facilities in the federal system held 9,400 prisoners. By 2013, that number had climbed to more than 31,000 in privately operated facilities, and that's just the feds. In the states, there are more than 92,000 prisoners, people who have been sentenced to prison, who are in privately operated facilities. That's, of course, in the state where there's more than 1.1 million in state operated facilities. In any case, it's a big number. Jason, What kind of business is private prisons?
So basically, the private prison companies are trying to run the same service as our public corrections models, and they try to do it a little bit cheaper, or in their words, a little bit more effectively. And I think that we live in a country where there's almost a national consensus that it's a mixed economy. So there certainly is a role for the private sector in a lot of our lives. I think the questions that a lot of us in the reform community have around private prisons is, to what degree does the profit model get in the way of our need to move people out of these places quickly, move sentencing reform and move the criminal justice reform agenda forward, and what role does the profit motive play in lobbying legislators to not make the changes that we need to see in the system. In a JPI report called Gaming the System, which is on the Justice Policy Institute website, you can read about the triangle between some of these companies, their lobbying efforts, and elected officials taking funds from them and some of the policy outcomes we see. So as someone who lives in this country and now is an American citizen, I'm not opposed to there being a private sector. I don't think that we should bar there being a private sector role in rehabilitation, but it's incumbent upon all of us to look a lot more carefully at what these companies are doing in the political process and whether or not people that are in these for-profit facilities are being kept safe, getting the services they need, and have the transparency and oversight that we would at least see in the public system.
Now, is the U.S. unique in its private prisons? Does Canada? Do any of the EU nations engage in private? I don't think so, but I'm really not sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is also not my deepest area of expertise, but I do know this. A lot of the companies that started in this country are now marketing their model all around the world, and particularly where you've got countries that are facing deep fiscal shortfalls, the companies will come in and offer 5 years, basically 5 years free incarceration in a place. They'll build a facility. Then they'll say, we'll serve these people in these facilities for a number of years, which if you're an elected official in a poor place, it's very hard to say no to that if you're being lobbied around public safety issues. I think the biggest challenges that we face in this country are around the role that these companies play in our political process, and any elected official needs to heavily scrutinize any of these bids coming in around whether they would really meet the needs of the population that they say they're going to serve, or and whether that should be done through the public sector instead.
Indeed. Again, the number to call if you have questions or comments. Want to say hi to my guest, Jason Seidenberg from the Justice Policy Institute. The number is 503-231-8187. And let's shift over to something that's a neat innovation, or some of that's, you know, good news is a good thing. Up in Seattle, they've been pioneering something called Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, LEAD. Rather than arrest them and put them in jail and then send them maybe to social services, in Seattle, they're actually encouraging their officers to simply direct people into the needed social services. It's a pre-arrest, is an odd way to put it, I suppose, but that's what they're doing. Now, I guess this model is starting to take off and is becoming more popular. There was a conference in D.C. Jason, what do you know about this LEAD thing?
So the LEAD model is one of a number of models that's seeking to keep problems that aren't really public safety or criminal justice problems out of the criminal justice system. It's an expansion of diversion, which has been a tool that we've had in the system for decades, but really now starting to focus in on working with the police, working with the courts to say that when somebody presents to law enforcement with a certain behavior, can that behavior be dealt with outside the criminal justice system so that person avoids the conviction, the arrest, and all the negative consequences that come with deeper system involvement. Where it's worked well is where police get to work with mental health, get to work with treatment providers, get to work with housing providers. It's worked well in places like Seattle where there's a more thoughtful elected leadership that oversees all these things and are basically redrawing lines and redrawing boundaries. So this is all good news, and particularly when we have all of these policing controversies around the country around the use of force and around what happens to people when they come into contact with law enforcement, diversion is a great way to start moving large numbers of people out of the criminal justice system who do not need to be there.
It's, it seems like a no-brainer. It seems like common sense, but as you and I both know, common sense is an oxymoron, especially when you're talking about our criminal justice system. So, I'm still going to keep talking for a minute. Let's talk about racial bias for a minute. I mean, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, I'm quoting here, black males had higher imprisonment rates across all age groups than all other races and Hispanic males. In the age range with the highest imprisonment rates for males, ages 25 to 39, black males were imprisoned at rates at least 2.5 times greater than Hispanic males and 6 times greater than white males. And it goes on, the numbers are just scary. Then you look at the crime statistics and reported crime. We can't even clear more than 20% of the property crimes that get reported each year. We can't clear more than 50% of the violent crimes that are reported this year. And those are the reported crimes, you know, forgetting about the ones that happen that just don't get reported. Now, I think that the emphasis on the racially biased enforcement, that the socioeconomically biased enforcement, has created a sort of group of the usual suspects. And I think that focusing on certain populations may be one of the reasons. I mean, we don't see a lot of overprivileged, white kids getting busted for various offenses, but you see underprivileged African American kids or Hispanic kids being busted for those things. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that might be part of the problem. But what do you think?
So I really appreciate your focus, Doug, on kids and young people. We know a lot more about the racial disparity issue about young people, so I'm just going to try to address that for a minute. What we know is that most young people go through a stage of delinquency, or another way of saying that is they get involved in juvenile crime. Most kids do. I certainly did. And if you generally query a bunch of people, they'll kind of own up to that in a minute. And there's statistics that are published through Health and Human Services that show upwards of a third of young people engage in assaultive behavior, fights in school. There's even a statistic that's something like 5% of all young people reported having a gun in the last 30 days. You know, there's a country with almost 300 million guns, so we shouldn't be all that surprised by that. What happens is some kids get pushed into the system for these behaviors. Some kids end up being arrested, ending up in the juvenile justice system, and some kids don't. And the kids who end up doing so tend to be in schools where there's a tough-on-crime mentality or a zero-tolerance mentality, and young people are referred to the juvenile justice system when they could have been referred to the principal's office. Or the policing, the way policing is done in a community focuses on one community more than another. So you might think, well, that would make that community safer, wouldn't it, to have a higher level of policing? Well, not really. The places that we see the biggest concentration of law enforcement actually tend to be places that are less safe. And finally, coming out of this, if you can imagine higher levels of policing in some communities, you can also imagine, well, that's going to have an impact on the race and ethnicity of who ends up locked up. That's basically what we are seeing in our criminal justice system around the big racial and ethnic disparities that the president talked about yesterday. How do we address that? We address that through reforms that start in the places where criminal justice involvement is the greatest. We start with reforms like we're seeing in Seattle with expansion of diversion. We start with sentencing reform that really cuts the amount of time somebody's locked up, and we give our courts and our systems the tools they need to hold people accountable for behavior, but not push people deeper into the system when that just isn't warranted. If we started doing that, maybe we could see a criminal justice system that didn't have these horrific racial disparities that they do, which have a devastating impact on both the African-American community, Latino community, and other ethnic and racial minority communities in the United States. So if we really want to be a fair and just and equal society, we have to move on these criminal justice reforms, because they are standing in the way of the kind of country that we want to see, particularly as it relates to racial and ethnic disparities.
So true, so true. I just keep sitting here going, yeah, what he said. By the way, you're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Of course, you knew that. I'm your guest host, Doug McVeigh. Hi, you may not have known that. I'm sitting in this week for Paul Rowland. He will be back some of these days. But in the meantime, we're speaking this morning with Jason Zeidenberg from the Justice Policy Institute. They're an organization that works to reform the criminal justice system and do research and see what works and what doesn't. And today we're talking about criminal justice reform and sentencing reform and efforts to reduce over-incarceration. The number to call if you have a question or comment is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Jason, what sort of things are you working on these days? What kind of research are you and JPI doing?
Well, this is an interesting time to have a call. I think Doug, you're very familiar with the work of the Justice Policy Institute, and your role as a criminal justice reformer too gives you an opportunity to sort of understand the moment that we're in. I think that 15 years ago, when a lot of these reform organizations got going, we were very focused on saying mass incarceration's a problem, look at the size of the incarceration rate, America take note. So the good news is, I think we got America to take note. I think people got the message. Too many people locked up. Our work now is a lot more focused on these reforms that take bites at the apple of mass incarceration and start trying to move chunks of people out of the criminal justice system and back home. One of the big things that we're involved in is a juvenile justice initiative called JDAI, the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative. Multnomah County, or Portland, Oregon, where you live, is a model site for that, and it seeks to reduce the number of kids who are in pretrial detention who do not need to be there, who can be at home, be held accountable for their behavior, and be served by the system differently without being locked up. We're also involved in a bunch of research projects that are looking at the specific challenges in specific states or specific communities that see too many people ending up in the criminal justice system. In the past year, we did a report that looked at parole in Maryland and found that the biggest challenge people faced when they were coming out of prison in Maryland was housing and employment. And this was a perspective shared both by the individuals coming out of prison and their officers, their parole officers and community correction staff. So what that speaks to is a focus on employment, making sure people are connected to jobs, making sure employers are connected to community supervision agencies, and making sure that any barriers that someone has to getting a job when they come out of prison is eliminated. So I don't know if that's helpful, Doug, but basically JPI's work now is much more focused on the very specific policy reforms that we need to see happen in states and localities to start getting on top of this problem. I think the final thing I would sort of put out to your listeners that we need to start focusing in on is we've had a lot of success in juvenile justice reform recently, seeing the number of people who are locked up significantly reduced when they're juveniles. That's good news. If you look at the research, and this research informs everything from Supreme Court rulings to how we deal with driver's licenses, you see this emerging notion that a young person's brain isn't fully developed into their mid-20s. I certainly know that I had challenges as an adolescent. What we need to do next is sort of shift the adult criminal justice system that treats adults, particularly young adults, more like the way the juvenile justice system does. So we need to see more people diverted early on, like the LEAD model. We need to see fewer young adults locked up. If a young adult ends up engaging in behavior where they need to be held accountable and they need to be out of the community for some period of time, that very small group should be, you know, in the system as short as possible and then get home. More treatment targeted at these folks. If we started doing that, particularly with the 18 to 25-year-olds, we think we might see an even bigger drop in the number of people locked up in this country. So we think that the 18 to 25 group is critical. And I'm hopeful that we can build on the momentum we've seen in juvenile justice reform and really target adult criminal justice reform by starting with the young adults.
You know, it's sentencing reform, criminal justice reform, and yet so many of the things that are needed for this are social services and other and services in the community. Oregon has a terrible on-time graduation rate for high school students. Portland has an awful on-time graduation rate. I mean, they've made minor improvements, but it's still awful. And you know, things like that. Do you think that getting a better education system would actually help?
Sure. I think that there's two aspects to the services that any person needs. The service that any person needs, good schools, connection to work, treatment when they need it, the ability to live in safe and sustainable housing, that particularly has to be available to people who are at risk for coming into the criminal justice system. There is also a group of people that they simply don't need to be arrested. They simply don't need to be coming into the system. And this word that you were talking about earlier, over-criminalization, applies to this group. So there is a group of people that have deeper needs that we simply need to address, and then we won't see them in the criminal justice system the way that we are. Then there's a group, we simply don't need to have them in the criminal justice system.
Indeed. You know, I said I wasn't going to talk about it, but I just, there's even a thing later on today. But as you know, Oregon passed a marijuana legalization ballot measure back in November. And so we now have limited legalization for people over the age of 21 in private for limited amounts they can cultivate and possess. And eventually we'll have retail sales. Now, that will obviously reduce the number of people. Hopefully, reduce the number of people being arrested. It's thought of as decriminalized in Oregon, but people forget that it's still criminal. It really decriminalization is possibly the wrong word for it. What kind of impact do you think that real decriminalization could have on a state?
So this is an area that I'm not as much of an expert in, and don't spend a lot of my time in, but I think it's very clear that if we could free up the resources that we're currently spending on the prohibition of drugs, particularly drugs that the science has told us really doesn't have a harmful impact, or if it does, it's way less harmful than alcohol. And second, that our response to marijuana is worse than any impact it could ever have. If we can shift our policies so that we're not doing harm to people and we're decriminalizing a drug that really doesn't have the negative impact that people thought it did 40, 50 years ago, I think we would be able to free up the resources to focus on real public safety and human service challenges that happen. This community that I live in, Washington, D.C., passed an initiative last year that basically told Congress we'd like to decriminalize most drugs. We actually pushed for a tax and regulate system, and you're well aware of this, because of the way the Congress relates to D.C., we got a sort of mixed bag reform. But there's enough of a reform model got through there that you are seeing people growing marijuana in their homes or growing it so they can trade on the street. It'll be interesting to see whether the nation's capital and our modest advance towards decriminalization is something that the rest of the country will be looking at and saying, well, if D.C. could do it, why the hell isn't Oregon doing it?
Well, indeed. And anything that can, I mean, there's research talking about how people age out, that because it's easier as a young person under the age of 21, it's easier to buy marijuana than it is to buy alcohol. That's what the research shows. When it talks about getting, just obtaining, well, it's easier for a kid to obtain alcohol because they just steal it from their parents or from an older sibling. That's a difference between getting and buying. So when they reach the age of 21, there's research showing that, or asserting at least, that people tend to reduce or stop their use of marijuana and start using alcohol because, look, we're over 21, we can buy this stuff. And so with legalization, it'll be interesting to see because, well, you and I both know that alcohol's involvement with criminal behavior, in particular violent crime, is, indisputable. And, the data is just, it's just sad.
Yeah, I don't know if any of my district attorney friends who I worked with in Oregon are listening. Most of them, if you had a conversation with them about the prohibition laws, they would actually say, I'm not really interested in spending any time on this whatsoever. We've got real public safety concerns in our community. This isn't a public safety concern. So that's one way of sort of attacking the problem. The other way is talking about the science, which shows the minimal negative impact, particularly compared to a whole bunch of other drugs. And then finally, there really is and should be in this country an understanding that you are free to do a certain set of things absent direct harm to others. We certainly do that around cigarettes. We certainly do that around alcohol. There are negative, documented negative effects of both of those. As opposed to marijuana, the science is like, it has an impact, but not nearly as negative as these other things. So, Doug, I think we need to push a lot harder on criminal justice reform writ large, particularly sentencing. I think we're going to be fighting that battle forever. And we can't be fighting it forever because people are negatively impacted by long prison sentences. The good news is what's happening around marijuana is opening up the space for a larger conversation about the role of the criminal justice system in our lives. So I think that's the good news, and hopefully we'll see Oregon move in the right direction soon.
Hopefully so. Remember, folks, you're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO. I am your guest host, Doug McVeigh, sitting in this week for Paul Rowland. We're talking with Jason Zeidenberg from the Justice Policy Institute, and we have a caller on the line. Michael, how you doing this morning?
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions, but I'd first like to say that the recent focus on criminal justice reform is very encouraging, considering the millions of people that are with arrest records and convictions right now. That being said, it seems like the current popular rhetoric is focused around so-called nonviolent drug offenders. My question is, what about individuals whose crimes are categorized as violent offenses? As your guests may know, prosecutorial discretion can mean the difference between a law-abiding citizen and a convicted criminal, or the difference between someone being convicted of disorderly conduct or having a conviction for assault. Further complicating these issues are things like explicit and implicit racial bias, inconsistent application of the law in various legal jurisdictions across the country. I'd like to know what your guest feels about reform efforts that include all convicted individuals, not just nonviolent drug offenders. And in particular, individuals that demonstrate an ability for reform. Now, I know, there are people who are repeat offenders, so-called jailbirds, who may be in and out of the system, but there also are individuals who may have had, an offense and, made an effort to reform their lives, how do you feel about efforts in general to reform the entire system as a whole, including violent offenders?
That's a good last question to end on. I think we are not going to reduce the prison population in this country unless we have a more robust conversation about everybody who is in prison. There are people that are serving very long sentences right now who were convicted of a violent crime. All the data, all the research shows that there's a certain point in their incarceration where we are not getting any impact whatsoever from a public safety perspective. We are just spending money on them and in many ways making them worse by the conditions that are in place in these facilities. It's sort of a question back to the public, really, because we elect DAs in many places. We elect politicians that put in these laws. Is your vision of justice one where we hold people accountable with these long prison terms, even though the science tells us we're having no impact or a negative one? So I think that in terms of people that have been defined by a violent act in their past, we need to be looking much more closely at whether the length of the sentence is really achieving what we want as taxpayers and as citizens that want public safety. And if we're not, then we need to put on the table that someone serving a long prison term for a violent offense, maybe that term needs to be cut.
And with that, we're going to have to wrap up. Jason, thank you so much for being with us this morning. I'm Doug McVeigh, your guest host. Wednesday Talk Radio, our regular host, Paul Rowland, is out at the moment. Jason Zeidenberg, our guest, Director of Policy and Research for the Justice Policy Institute. Again, Jason, thank you so much, and have a great morning, everybody.
Thank you, Doug, and thank you to your listeners.
I hang my head and cry. Dining car, they're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KABU is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and